Well, good evening, and welcome to tonight's Free Range Conversation. I'm John Piotti, the president of American Farmland Trust, and tonight we are so pleased to have a very special guest, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, with us. We'll get started in just a minute. Right now, we are calling out to literally thousands of American Farmland Trust members across the country, and it's going to take a few minutes for everyone to join in. Now, the format of tonight's event, I'm going to first say a few words up front, and then we're going to ask Secretary Vilsack a few initial questions, and then later we'll open it up to your questions. You can get in the queue to ask a question by pushing zero on your phone at any time, and a member of AFT staff will connect with you and put you on the list. We're also live tweeting this event and taking questions on Twitter using the hashtag FreeRangeAFT. So you can join the conversation online at any point during the call. If this is your first exposure to one of these events, we do them in two ways. A few times a year, I hold a town hall call-in program like this. And then on a regular basis, a very talented member of our staff, Greg Plotkin, conducts live stream interviews with different people in agriculture. You can find a listing of our free range conversations on our website. Now, given the Secretary's presence tonight, we know we're drawing some people who are not already American Farmland Trust members. So for their benefit, I'm going to say a few words up front about AFT. Now, some people are familiar with our iconic green and white bumper sticker, no farms, no food, but they know little of the organization that's behind it. American Farmland Trust was created 41 years ago in 1980, and we were the first national organization that viewed agriculture and the environment as two sides of the same coin. Back then, farmers and environmentalists were almost always at odds. And AFT was formed to pull those two worlds together. Now, perhaps because we were operating in new territory, we had an outsized impact almost immediately with the passage of the Farmland Protection Policy Act in 1981. And then AFT formed and led the coalition that incorporated the first conservation title into the Farm Bill. That was in 1985. And that, of course, has led to all that's happened with conservation programs since then. But AFT didn't focus only on federal policy. We helped 29 states develop farmland protection programs and even more states to adopt or refine current use taxation programs on which so many farmers and ranchers rely. I could go on and on, but in summary, I'll simply say that American Farmland Trust has been responsible for permanently protecting almost 7 million acres of farmland, for advancing sound farming practices on millions of acres more, and for providing support or services that have helped over 500,000 farmers and ranchers stay on the land. AFT takes a holistic approach to agriculture, one that involves the land itself, the practices employed on that land, and the people who steward that land. We're also unique in that we have a strong research arm that we use to guide public policy. Yet at the same time, we do some real work out in the field as demonstration projects to ground us in the realities of farming. It's a testament to AFT's success over the years that today so many environmental groups view farmers as critical partners, and that farm organizations recognize the importance of conservation practices. Now, I apologize to all the AFT members on the phone who already knew everything I just said. But if you're not a member, I urge you to go to our website and join. It's critically important that we engage as many people as possible so you know about our latest research, you can respond to our action alerts, and beyond that, we'll get you all the no food, no farms, no food bumper stickers you want. Anyway, it is great to have this event tonight. We are at this point have about 2,300 people on the call. It's great to see. I think the reason is our guest. It's a real pleasure and privilege to have Tom Vilsack with us tonight. He is, of course, someone the agricultural community knows well, having previously served as secretary for all 8 years of the Obama administration. Prior to that, he was Iowa's governor for 2 terms. And most recently, he served as CEO of the U.S. Dairy Export Council. Tom Vilsack is as well-versed as anyone in the challenges and the opportunities facing farming. Mr. Secretary, it's great to have you here tonight.
John, it's great to be with you and great to be with all of the folks who are members of the Trust and those who are going to sign up tonight to be members.
I like your plug. That's great. Well, we have so much that we want to cover tonight, but we really need to start out with the big issue that continues to consume us all, the pandemic. So, Mr. Secretary, give us your thoughts on the pandemic's impact on agriculture and rural America, and then talk about what USDA is doing to help. And in particular, talk about the parts of the recently passed American Rescue Plan Act that support agriculture.
Well, John, I think it's in order to respond to your question fully and comprehensively, I think we have to go back in time to mm-hmm. the beginning of the pandemic. And when we saw a significant disruption in the supply chain that we got used to in the United States, 50% of the food that is consumed in the U.S. is consumed through the food service aspect of our economy. When food service essentially shut down, I think it's fair to say we had a bit of a problem transitioning from food service to food assistance. And as a result, we saw, unfortunately, the destruction and dumping of products from farms because it simply couldn't be processed in time. We also saw a failure on the part of some processing facilities to care about the health and welfare of their workers, which resulted in massive sickness and disruption at processing facilities that ultimately led to those processing facilities shutting down for a period of time. That also caused disruption. So what we saw in the initial stages of COVID was a lack of resiliency in our food supply system. And the result of that impacted not only those working in the supply chain, but also farmers who were selling into that supply chain. It also had an impact on trade. Obviously, when other countries saw the same level of disruption occur, fortunately for us and from a trading perspective, many Asian countries responded to the COVID more quickly and more forcefully and were able to reopen their economies more quickly. But there was still a significant impact on our farmers. That resulted in the government putting together a significant aid package, which highlighted another concern within our system, and that is the equity concern. We've been talking a lot about that because I'm going to get to the American Rescue Plan. And as you know, in the American Rescue Plan, there is a significant opportunity for debt relief for socially disadvantaged farmers. And one of the reasons for that debt relief is the fact that about 99% of the $35 billion that was provided in the way of support for farmers, about 99% of that actually went to white farmers. About 1% went to socially disadvantaged farmers. And so the bulk of the assistance that was developed went to white farmers, and specifically to large-scale white farmers. 60% of those proceeds went to the top 10%, to the top 10% of farmers. 0.26%, that's 0.25%, went to the bottom 10%. So you see there was a significant gap that was created in terms of the assistance and help. And so the COVID situation has caused us to think about the lack of resilience in our system and also about the equity of our system. In rural America, there was also a significant impact from a healthcare perspective. People, first of all, were led to believe this wasn't going to be a serious problem. Turned out it was. Fairly significantly high rates of infection and sickness and unfortunately and tragically death. In rural places, it overtaxed the healthcare system that's limited to begin with. People in rural America are a little bit older. They have more chronic conditions. And so there was a healthcare impact as well. So we got to the American Rescue Plan. And President Biden, he believes that it's important to deal with both the healthcare crisis and the economic crisis. That's why on the healthcare side, expanded vaccination efforts, expanded opportunities to put more people in the field, providing the shots, more vaccine available for those shots, and more places for people conveniently to get the shots. And it's obviously working because we're seeing millions and millions of Americans every single day being vaccinated. You also had to deal, however, with the economic side of this. And it breaks down into a couple of different categories, all of which have a direct impact on farmers in this country. To the extent that you increase SNAP benefits, provide resources for parents whose children weren't in school, and now those parents have to pay for school breakfast or for a breakfast or lunch that might otherwise have been provided in a school, that's an additional economic burden on families that might have been stressed to begin with, might have been further stressed by unemployment or hours being cut. So financial resources were provided and are being provided through the nutrition programs to provide help and assistance to these families. And we're purchasing more commodities and providing those through the food bank and food pantry system. 15 cents of every food dollar that's spent in the grocery store ultimately ends up in the pocket of a farmer. So in a sense, as you increase and expand significantly, and in fact doubling really the help and assistance that we've provided in the past in terms of nutrition, you essentially are impacting ultimately and affecting farmer income. We also looked at supply chain assistance, that issue of resiliency. And the American Rescue Plan creates the opportunity for the Department of Agriculture to begin the process of addressing that in a very specific and real way. And I think one of the focuses that we'll be looking at is the processing side. I think we found that when one or two processing facilities shut down, it created this amazing disruption. It put the spotlight on the fact that our processing capacity in the United States is very much consolidated. And perhaps we need a few more processing facilities around the country to take some of the pressure off in the event of a disruption like we've occurred. So you'll be seeing, I think, the Department of Agriculture using the supply chain assistance resources from the American Rescue Plan to look at ways in which we can expand access to processing. I mentioned the debt relief program for socially disadvantaged farmers. I can go into great detail on that, but at the end of the day, this is designed to reflect the cumulative effect of discrimination that took place years ago at USDA. Farmers were not able to benefit from all of the suite of activities and benefits of USDA. Their white neighbors were able to take the full advantage of all those programs. And over time, a significant gap existed between very successful white farmers and struggling socially disadvantaged farmers. The debt relief is designed to basically begin to close that gap, to acknowledge the discrimination and the cumulative effect of discrimination, and also to respond to the fact that the COVID relief packages were disproportionately helping, if you will, folks at the top. In addition to the debt relief, we're also empowered under this American Rescue Plan to begin the process of helping create new market access and new land access for these socially disadvantaged producers. The opportunity for us to work with community building organizations and others to be able to identify land that could potentially be available to make it affordable and available to socially disadvantaged farmers to deal with the heirs property issues that black farmers have been plagued with for so long. This is an opportunity for us to really address fundamentally those issues and to begin the process, taking very important first steps, if you will. And then that, in turn, should educate us about what additional steps need to be taken as we look at the 2023 Farm Bill. The last thing I will say on this question is, on the healthcare side, the American Rescue Plan also provided $500 million to our community facility program at USDA to assist healthcare facilities that are located in rural communities that may have been strapped financially because of COVID, may want to expand telehealth opportunities to perhaps do a better job of caring for more people in a more effective way, or are in the process of expanding their vaccination efforts and need a little additional resource. This $500 million will help many, many of these small community health facilities basically keep the doors open and provide that necessary health care for folks in rural places. So that's a very quick response to your question, but it's a, it,
That was a very comprehensive answer. That was fantastic. And I know that probably many members of my staff and the AFT board were jumping up and down when you said a number of things, including the focus on land access and affordability and trying to better serve some of the historically underserved communities. It's so great to hear that coming from the top at USDA. Right now we have we just passed the 5,500 mark, 5,511 people now on the call. It's great to have you here. If you've just tuned in, I'm John Fiotti, the president of American Farmland Trust, and our very special guest tonight is U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. If you want to ask a question at any time, you can press zero on your phone. We'll be taking a few questions from the audience in the not-too-distant future. But first, a second question from me. We've been talking about the pandemic, but that's not the only crisis that we're all thinking about. There's another crisis out there that we also need to deal with forthrightly, the climate crisis. AFT has been promoting better soil health for decades, and it's great to finally see the growing public awareness that farming can be part of the climate solution. Now, I know that advancing regenerative practices and Climate Smart Ag is a high priority for you, Mr. Secretary, because we've communicated about it. But tell us a little bit about how you're going to make this a real priority within USDA.
Well, we want to encourage every aspect of USDA to have a role, a 360-degree approach to climate. And basically, our big idea that comes out of this is, despite the existential threat that climate change represents to all of us, we think there is an incredibly large opportunity side to the climate discussion, particularly as it relates to agriculture and rural America. We think that it can fundamentally change the direction of agriculture in the U.S. and also create much more prosperity in rural communities. Now, how do we do that? Well, first of all, we need to engage every tool available at USDA to focus it on this opportunity. We know that there are 45 practices that are referred to as climate smart agricultural practices, regenerative agricultural practices. We know that if we focus our conservation resources, there will be greater adoption of those 45 practices, and that will be a benefit in terms of soil health, carbon capture and sequestration, better water, better wildlife habitat. But it's got to be more than that. It also has to be the opportunity to look at our CRP program, a program that currently is underutilized. It was during the Trump administration by about 4 million acres. We think there are opportunities to really ramp up the CRP program, get that back to where it needs to be, and maybe even then some, so that we have opportunities to utilize that program fully and completely. We think that there's a regional conservation partnership program focus where we're looking at large-scale watersheds and landscapes to encourage a collaborative effort that would be climate-oriented. So it's not just an individual farm. It's not just a couple of farms in an area. It's a large-scale, massive program that involves multiple partners, multiple farmsteads, in a way to encourage climate smart practices. We're going to encourage and invest more in our climate hubs. So we do the assessment, the evaluation, the extension of information that farmers can then use to be better climate stewards. We think there's a terrific opportunity on the research side. We're already creating a multitude of decision tools to make it easier for people to be climate smart. We want to shorten the supply chain. I mentioned the importance of expanding processing capacity. That has a carbon footprint. Local and regional food systems and the development of more of those so food doesn't have to travel quite as far, also important. Proper forest management, key. A civilian climate core that puts hopefully thousands of people to work, assisting and helping in adaptation and mitigation strategies. Using the procurement capacity and power of the federal government to support climate-friendly businesses, and also taking a look at establishing, you can call it a market, you could call it a bank, you can call it a fund, but essentially providing some mechanism by which we can incent, pay, compensate farmers for the sequestration of carbon. We think there is a tremendous opportunity to shape a fund in a way that is very farmer-specific. the markets today, the carbon markets today, aren't really designed for farmers. There's a lot of paperwork. There's a bit of a hassle. The charge or the credit is not as valuable as it needs to be in order to get people's attention. So very few of those credits have actually been invested, if you will, in agricultural practices. We think at USDA we have the resources and the flexibility and the smarts and the input from farmers, most importantly of all, to be able to fashion and create a carbon fund that will essentially allow us to encourage more investment, more sequestration of land. I'm sure we're going to get to talk about the 30-30 program, so I'm not going to talk specifically about that, but there's a role there for it to be played as well in the climate discussion. Key here is creating revenue streams, creating ways in which agricultural waste can be converted into a multitude of new products to move away from fossil fuels, to create a more circular, more regenerative economy on the farm, creating multiple revenue streams. We think American agriculture is ready for this. They understand the market is going to demand it. And they are obviously very interested in making sure that we don't continue to lose roughly 4 tons of topsoil per acre per year. We can't continue to sustain that. And we certainly can't continue to sustain the loss of farmland to development at the rate that one of your recent reports suggested, about 2,000 acres a day being lost. That's a tremendous loss every single day of this great farmland.
Well, it's great to hear that statement of priorities. It's wonderful. And I know we're going to have other questions from the audience about different regenerative practices, because I'm seeing some of them pop up here, and we also got the advance questions from registrants. But I want to focus on just one of those 45 climate smart practices that you mentioned. One of them is, of course, cover crops, a major one. And you're very familiar with the program in Iowa that helps farmers out with a cover crop premium discount. That's been extended now to Illinois. AFT's played a big hand in expanding that. We're trying to work with some other states now, expand it broader. Do you see a program like that as something that could ultimately be applied at the national level, perhaps as part of the next farm bill?
I think there are multiple ways to encourage cover crops. That's one way that absolutely should be looked at. The ability in terms of creating markets for the cover crops, one of the issues here is if you're asking a farmer to incur expense, even if you defer some of that expense, it's still a bottom line issue for farmers. Mm-hmm. And so how can you create the market for whatever it is that cover crop is? I think there's also additional crop insurance activities and benefits that could accrue from a wide array of climate smart practices, not just cover crops. So I think finding markets, reducing the risk, all I think are important to expanding significantly the utilization of cover crops.
Great, great. Well, we've been talking about regenerative practices as a climate solution. I can't do that and not bring up something you alluded to, but I want to go a little deeper, and that's the underlying land base. At AFT, we see those two issues as interconnected. We're never going to realize all the climate benefits we need from regenerative practices if that land doesn't continue to be stewarded well. And if a farm field becomes a housing development in 20 years, all those carbon benefits evaporate. We also think the carbon markets that you were talking about, critically important, but they're going to demand that the practices continue for a while. And that suggests also the need for more permanent farmland protection. So anyway, ASAP, ASAP Ale program, it's a great program, but it's a drop in the bucket of what's needed. So my question for you is, does this administration intend to significantly step up ASAP or devise some new farmland protection programs? And in answering that, I'll give you a chance to reflect on the program you mentioned a moment ago, 30 by 30, which we're quite excited about at AFT. How do you see that goal potentially applied to working land? Can we aim to protect or conserve 30% of our working land by 2030?
Well, I think first and foremost, we are in the process of doing a series of outreach meetings on the 30 by 30 program, and for that matter, on all of these issues. The president has directed us to get input from farmers, ranchers, and producers to make sure that as we fashion programs, as we expand programs, as we invest in programs over the course of the next 4 years, that we're doing it consistent with what farmers believe is appropriate. And that's certainly true of the 30-30 effort. We're also making sure that we do appropriate outreach. And I think it's a combination of many things in order for us to get to that 30-30 goal, which the president has articulated. I think it's CRP. I think it's targeted conservation efforts. Yes, uh-huh. I think it's easements and looking for ways in which those can be popular. And we certainly celebrated recognizing small, but still a milestone, 5 million acres in easements, in large part because of the work of the trust and others who have been encouraging more farmland to go into easements. So I think it's a collaborative effort. I think it's also important for us to continue to look for market opportunities to figure out ways in which the private sector and the philanthropic sector can be engaged in this, can partner and leverage with the resources that federal and state governments are making available to the farm community. It's got to be incentive-based. I think if you try to mandate certain actions and activities, there's always a pushback and yep. there's litigation and there's 5,000 ways to get around something. But if you incent folks, and if a farmer looks yep. across the fence and sees his farmer, his neighbor doing pretty well financially, he's going to know what's going on. And he can say, well, I just got an easement. I got a payment for CRP. I've got a targeted conservation. I'm involved in these markets. I got multitude of new revenue streams that I didn't have before, and I'm taking full advantage of all of them. And I think it's got to be based on science. And clearly, the private working lands have got to be part of the 30 by 30 effort. They have to be part of it. You can't get to 30 by 30 if you don't engage the private working lands. And I think with the proper incentives and the proper science, we can get there. I should also say that we also have to do something on the public lands. Many of the public lands obviously are forested lands. And frankly, we could do all of this on the agricultural side. And if we don't properly maintain our forests, we're going to continue to have these horrific forest fires, and the carbon's going to go up in smoke anyway. So we have to have both. We can't just do private working lands. We just can't do public lands. We have to do both.
Yeah. One of the themes you've struck in everything you've said tonight that I just want to note is the comprehensive approach. There's many pieces. There's not a silver bullet here. There's more silver buckshot, right? You need a whole bunch of strategies because it's a system, and you need a range of strategies to make things work. And I really applaud you for thinking that way. I know sometimes it's a challenge for bureaucracies to act that way. They are customarily in silos, but it starts at the top, and I just applaud the way you're thinking about this. I'm
going to
shift to some. I'm sorry. Go on. Yes, please.
Well, I two things. First of all, I'm going to use that buckshot analogy. That's a great one.
Good.
Thank you. Every once in a while, I'll attribute it to you, but I can't guarantee that every time I attribute it to you. I'll tell you what. The bureaucracy, and more importantly, American agriculture is ready for this.
Yes.
They want this. They're interested. They're excited about it. They're asking questions. They want to be at the front of this. And frankly, John, if we're serious about climate change in terms of our total the national effort, agriculture, rural lands will have early wins, if you will, much quicker than some of the other industries that have to also step up, whether it's transportation or utilities or construction or whatever. Agriculture has an opportunity to be an early leader and an early winner in this process.
Couldn't agree with you more. We're going to turn to some audience questions at this time, or participant questions. We've got a lot that are out there. We'll try to handle a few, and then I want to respect the people who sent in questions early as well. I always want to reward good behavior, folks who did their homework, and we'll be reading some of those questions. But we're going to start with Pam in Oklahoma. So, Pam, can you hear me, and are you ready to speak?
Good evening. Thank you, Secretary. Given that women are continuing their positive and important influence on society, what will your administration do to provide programs that advance women and other minorities in agriculture, particularly owner-operators of family farms?
Well, we've got a beginning farmer and rancher program that has an advisory board and group. Obviously, they make a set of recommendations to U.S. agriculture. We've obviously seen an increase in women producers, which is a good thing, significant increase in women producers. It's a combination of things. It's making sure that women have access to credit. It's making sure that women have access to the information and technical assistance that NRCS can provide in terms of conservation. It's making sure that we look in terms of procurement opportunities at ways in which we can benefit and assist socially disadvantaged women operations. It's across the board, and USDA is committed. When I was secretary the last time, we actually had a women in agriculture group. The deputy secretary, once she's confirmed, I'm sure is going to be quite interested in continuing this. She is currently the commissioner of agriculture in Virginia, Dr. Jewel Bernal. She's going to bring with her a tremendous interest in making sure that the opportunities for farming are expanded to all in the socially disadvantaged category as well as women. So we're going to do quite a bit in this space because we understand and appreciate, and frankly, not just domestically. It's not just a good idea for us to do this domestically. It's also an important message to send globally because 70% of the world's farmers are women. So if we're going to be providing help and assistance, if we're going to take a leadership role in climate, we've got to have women front and center because that's how we're going to be able to also encourage those outside of America to embrace climate smart practices.
That's great. A little plug for one of AFT's programs. We run a Women for the Land effort where we help women become aware of USDA programs. Sometimes they have been unfamiliar with them, or they feel some barriers to getting involved in those programs. It's been very successful. I think we're up to 10 or 12 states now. We get some funding from NRCS for it. So thank you, Mr. Secretary. And just a data point on that, of the women who have gone through the program, over 70% have made some major change in conservation practices as a result of feeling empowered. Very, very powerful. I have as the next caller, Mary from Virginia. Mary.
Hello. Secretary Vilsack, it's an honor to be listening here, and thank you for all you're doing. You talked some about USDA's focus on regenerative agriculture and...
Whoops, I'm sorry. I think that was my technical error. I don't know if we can get Mary back. I don't think we can. I'm so sorry, Mary. She had a question, I think, because I got to see it before I pulled it up. I'm sorry about this, Mr. Secretary. She had a question about how you're going to coordinate state and federal efforts around soil health and climate smart practices.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why Dr. Jewel Bernal was asked to be the deputy at the Department of Agriculture, because she currently serves as a state commissioner and obviously has her counterparts in the other 49 states that she knows and has been working with quite well. We have a very close relationship with the National Association of Ag Secretaries, Directors, and Commissioners, and that association allows us to basically work collaboratively on programs and projects. We take a lot of input, a lot of advice from commissioners and secretaries and directors of agriculture from all over the country. And several of those folks used to work for me and with me at USDA. My former chief of staff, Karen Ross, is the commissioner in California, the secretary in California. Alexis Taylor is the secretary in Ohio. So we have a number of folks. Michael Skews, who was acting deputy for a period of time, is back in his old post in Delaware. So we have a lot of leadership capacity within those states that are looking forward to working with us. And the key here, obviously, is to leverage our resources and not just leverage it, as I said earlier, with state resources, but also to make sure that we're in line with the philanthropic organizations. We're in line with the private sector. Private sector is beginning to invest a lot in these activities as well. And we want to make sure that it's all aligned, all working in the same direction, not at cross purposes.
Great. Great. Next question is from Michael in California. Michael, go ahead.
Hello. Hello, this is Michael Dimmick. Do you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes, we do.
Okay, great. Secretary Vilsack, was really pleased to hear your opening remarks about the increasing focus on regional food systems, the payments that would be made to farmers for their capture of carbon, and for the emphasis on increasing processing around the country. And I'm really curious to know what the efforts will be around ensuring that those investments are equitably distributed between large farmers, mid-sized farmers, and small farmers.
It's a great question. You'll be interested to know that we have established an internal working group within USDA to look at the issues involving equity. President Biden has an executive order directing us to look at all of our programs to make sure that across the board that we apply them equitably. There's also going to be an equity commission, which will be an outside look of experts coming in and also reviewing the programs at USDA. So from an equity perspective, we're going to have an introspective and retrospective examination of our programs to make sure that they are being administered fairly and appropriately. You know, we have a series of programs, and really one of the driving principles behind all of this is the belief that our system needs to be more diverse. It needs to be more diverse in terms of producers. It needs to be more diverse in terms of production methods. It needs to be more diverse in terms of what is grown and raised and in what cycle. It needs to be more diverse as well in terms of the size of operations. And one way we can help small and mid-sized operations is to create that alternative market, if you will, that local market, creating the farm-to-school program, creating a better understanding of how local and regional food systems can market to institutional purchasers of food so that you create your own market. You don't necessarily compete in the commodity-based market where the price is set based on what's happening not just in your neck of the woods, but halfway around the world. Creating that local and regional system, supporting it with credit expansion, supporting it with procurement capacity, supporting it with appropriate risk management tools and technical assistance, and making it easy to access all of that is incredibly important to building a strong, vibrant local and regional system that plays to the strengths of small and mid-sized operators. We'll see expanded markets. We'll look for additional support for farmers markets, additional support for food hubs that can aggregate and process food and provide it to institutional purchasers. We'll look for ways in which we can work with large-scale retailers as well to create market opportunities for small and mid-sized producers. We want diversity in American agriculture. We think it's healthier to have it.
Amen. That's great. Great to hear. Next question is from your home state. Leland from Iowa.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Is Leland?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you for letting me speak. I live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I'm just curious, Mr. Vilsack, can we have it both ways with industrial agriculture as it is today? And, you know, we sell billions of dollars worth of food to China and various other countries, you know, and can't we have it both ways and yet have a healthy soil and get a limit on global warming?
Leland, I will tell you, I think the market, whether it's selling overseas or selling domestically, is going to continue to demand more sustainability and proof of sustainability. You know, for 4 years I worked prior to getting this job again in the Dairy Export Council, and I can tell you on multiple occasions I was asked concerning the sustainability efforts of the U.S. dairy industry by overseas buyers. This is a growing concern in many key markets. People are deeply concerned about climate. They expect and want agriculture to step up, and I think American agriculture is prepared to do that. And I think that's the paradigm shift over time. That's going to change the way people look at things. If you create multiple income sources, it's going to give farmers multiple options instead of the traditional way of growing crops and feeding crops to livestock. That's obviously going to continue, but we need to create more, and here's why. And, John, this is an amazing statistic. ERS, the Economic Research Service, put out a chart not long ago, and it just startled me because it showed 89.6% of American farms, the income from those farms is not the majority of income generated by the people operating those farms. In other words, in 89.6% of farms in this country, the farm owner had to have outside farm income to be able to maintain the farm. We just can't have that. Now, you know, there are people like myself, you know, I own a farm, but that's not who we're talking about here. We're talking about the folks that Leland's talking about and the folks that Mike talked about. We've got to figure out alternative ways, additional income sources that are tied to conservation, that are tied to climate, that are tied to carbon sequestration, that are tied to creating a market for agricultural waste that doesn't exist today, that creates three, four, five different ways on that same farm today to make a living. And if you create that kind of diversity of opportunity, I think you're going to see a lot of shift, a lot of change in the way in which people approach farming. And hopefully over time, it means healthier soil, greater productivity, cleaner water, and a transition that allows us to be able to continue to meet an export market that is demanding sustainability as well as that local and regional food system or that domestic consumer that wants it as well.
Yeah. As I said at the beginning, you know, environment and agriculture are two sides of the same coin, right? And the linkage perhaps is the viability of the farm, and long term viability demands both. It demands a good business model. It means the right policies have to be in place to make things work. But you also have to long-term be thinking about the health of the soil, or you're not going to be in business. So great to hear your comments. I'm going to read one of the questions that came in earlier. Again, trying to reward people who do their homework. This is from Tim. He writes, "It's disappointing that there wasn't a big thrust for conservation in Biden's jobs and infrastructure package. Given the importance of better farming practices, both for farm viability and for climate, can you envision additional funding for conservation programs in some manner, I'm adding that, prior to the next farm bill?"
You know, it's interesting. Folks have to look at this thing holistically. You just can't pick one aspect and say, hey, there wasn't anything in this particular aspect that speaks to conservation. You have to take into consideration the American Rescue Plan, take into consideration the discretionary budget that was announced last week, the mandatory budget that will be announced later in probably in May, the American jobs. You have to look at all four of them. And until you have all four ahead in front of you, you really don't know the level of commitment that the total level of commitment the administration's making. You know, it's the mandatory budget that speaks to CRP, for example. Well, that could be a pretty significant investment, if you will, depending upon how bold you are in that space. You don't know the traditional role in budgeting. The traditional role is the farm bill will go out and say, you are authorized to spend X number of dollars on conservation projects. And then what happens is what it's called chimps, is they basically chimp the conservation resources, and they reduce the amount that you can actually spend on conservation. Okay. Uh-huh. Now that's the traditional, that happens in every budget. You know, maybe it doesn't happen this time. And if it doesn't happen, it means there's a whole lot more money for conservation than there was before. And then you have to take a look at the jobs plan and you say, well, what's that $1 billion for climate smart agriculture? What's that all about? What's the $15 billion of subsidized credit for bio-based product manufacturing? What is that all about? Is that maybe taking cover crops? Is that taking agricultural waste and converting it into something? Well, is that conservation? It may be. Well, what about the $10 billion that's going to potentially go to rural co-ops to convert from coal fire energy to clean energy? Well, what kind of clean energy could that be? Well, I don't know. Could it be solar? Could it be wind? Could it be biomass? Is that tied to farms? And what about the tax credit? That's a huge tax credit that's in this American Jobs Plan that increases the tax credit for carbon sequestration. Is that conservation? Well, gosh, I think it might be. So you have to look at all parts of this thing before you say, boy, you know, kind of disappointing. If you just look at one line item and say, hey, that's not much. But then when you start thinking about all these other line items, now you're talking about some serious resources. Also, by the way, there's drought resiliency resources in there. What is that all about? Is that the billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars for additional research? Could that also be, if you will, in the and demonstration projects? Can that also be in the conservation bucket? I mean, we're talking about a lot of money here. So, you know, I hope everybody, you know, let's see the total picture before we make judgments, and then we see how the resources are leveraged, or how the resources are draw additional investment before we make the conclusion that we're kind of disappointed it should have been more.
That's great. I'm going to read, it's more of a comment than a question, but I know being in the public sector, you sometimes don't get thanked enough. So I want to read this one. Someone wrote in, I would like to thank the secretary for his foresight last time in office in creating the highly successful Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program. And then he goes on to say, or she, I'm not sure who it is, certified farms are proving more profitable than non-certified, and the reductions in NP and soil and sediment loss are really great. So someone giving you a thumbs up for work well.
Well,
comments or reactions?
I appreciate that, and the folks in Minnesota were kind enough to give me a placard that celebrated their certification program, which they asked me to display in my office. Now, you know, I am the United States Secretary of Agriculture, but I am also from Iowa, and there's an interesting dynamic between Iowa and Minnesota. And so it was. I used to chide my Iowa friends how difficult it was for me to showcase what was going on in Minnesota when the same thing needed to go on in Iowa, because we've got some challenges on the water side. But look, it's a great program, and I'll tell you, we cut our teeth on programs like that. It's precisely what we're talking about. If you give people incentives, if you encourage them to do the right thing, if you give them the resources, they're going to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. Great. I have now Dawn from Illinois. Dawn, go ahead.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Can
you
hear me?
Go ahead, please.
Oh.
Yes.
I still can picture from early during the pandemic the pictures of the mountains of potatoes sitting in fields and the gallons of milk going down the drain. I'm just wondering what lasting lessons that situation has accrued and what it might help or direct in the future?
Great question. And it goes to the resiliency of our food supply system. Let me talk specifically about dairy, for example. It takes about $1.50 to process a gallon of milk to get it from the farm to the grocery store in a container that you would buy. It's difficult in a circumstance where farmers and processors are already losing money because food service has been shut off as it was. It's difficult to ask them to donate that, to incur that additional $1.50 in expense, because that will just make their loss even deeper. And that's why it led to the dumping of milk. So what we needed to do is we needed to eliminate, if you will, the disincentive to donate. And that's why Congress has provided resources for us at USDA to create a dairy donation program. So when and if we're in a situation in the future that we see a major disruption that could potentially cause farmers to have to dump milk. Instead of dumping it, there will be a resource that will allow them to not be economically disadvantaged and allow that resource to get into the food assistance system to provide help to families. The second component of this, which is also part of the American Rescue Plan, is to make sure that the food banks and the pantries are capable of receiving perishable items so that they don't have to be destroyed or dumped. And that means making sure that they have adequate storage, refrigeration capacity. And so that's why we are establishing and we'll be setting up grant programs and providing resources to food banks so that they will be able to expand their storage capacity, be able to expand their refrigeration capacity so they can accept more of these perishable items. And we just announced today, or yesterday, I guess, the development of a produce food box. It's a lesson learned from the Farms to Families food box program. There were some issues with that program, so we've taken what we think was the best aspect of it, creating a box of fruits and vegetables and providing it through our very efficient distribution system of the food banks that are located across the country so that people will have access to food that they might not otherwise have the capacity and the ability to purchase. We're also increasing the SNAP benefit for a period of time, which will also give folks a little additional resource. We're also increasing the WIC benefit for young moms and young children to be able to access more fruits and vegetables as well. So there's a lot of the lessons that we learned from the early days of the COVID is eliminating the disadvantage with donation programs, creating the capacity to accept perishables, and also creating a mechanism for distribution that is efficient and effective.
Great. Again, very comprehensive approach, exactly what's needed. I'm now going to go to Justine in South Dakota. Justine, you're on.
Hi, I am curious, and we've been getting a lot of questions down this way, as to the administration, their plans on the socially disadvantaged farmer rancher debt relief. Some of the things that people are curious about has been the time frame on debt repayment, if there is going to be any relief coming down to the pike for those who have applied and been denied in the past year due to various reasons. And we just want to kind of ask, you know, what the administration's looking at doing in all of those regards. And thank you guys for hosting this call and Secretary Vilsack for being here with us today.
You bet. The debt relief package was crafted by Congress. So obviously program is basically designed by Congress and has to be implemented by the Department of Agriculture. It essentially involves only those people, based on the statute, based on the law, only those people who have borrowed money from the Department of Agriculture, either through our direct loan program, our farm ownership or farm operating loan program, or our farm storage program, or who went to a commercial bank and had their loan guaranteed by the USDA and fall within the socially disadvantaged category. There's a specific definition of that. The definition is those folks who are designated as such based on racial or ethnicity factors. So it's, you know, it's roughly, I don't know, it's probably 15,000-16,000 people that we know of who have direct loans or guaranteed loans. So those loans over a period of time will be paid off. And you ask the question, well, why would you pay them off? Well, in large part because many of these folks were discriminated against for a number of years. And as a result of that discrimination, they were not able over a period of decades, to take full advantage of USDA programs. And as a result, their operations didn't grow or didn't grow at the rate that their neighbors down the road who had full access to USDA programs grew. And the proof of that is in the way in which the COVID relief monies were distributed under the previous administration. Again, I said this earlier, 99% of those resources, according to one study, went to white farmers. And the top 10% of farmers in that category received 60% of the billions of dollars that were provided in relief. The bottom 10%, the socially disadvantaged people of color, farmers, they received 0.26%. To state it another way, if you take a look at the people within the COVID relief packages who self-identified as either white or black or Hispanic, that represented about 25% of the total number of farmers who received COVID benefits. Of that number, that 25%, black farmers in that group received $20 million in help and assistance. Black farmers $20 million. White farmers in that category, self-identified, received $5.6 billion. So you see the gap? So the program here is designed to essentially say, look, that's a problem, because that's going to allow that gap between folks to grow, and it's going to mean we're going to have fewer farmers. At the end of the day, we want more farmers. We want to keep people on the land. So this plan is designed to respond to the cumulative effect of discrimination over a period of time, as well as to also recognize there was significant help provided to white farmers in COVID relief. This sort of balances it out a little bit. Now, you ask about individuals who were denied. Those who were denied in the past, I can tell you that they were part of, many of them were part of class action lawsuits that, when I was secretary before, were settled during the Obama administration for the first time in a decade. They had been struggling for quite a period of time to get some compensation through these class action cases, and they were settled, and the government paid several billion dollars to basically resolve many of those cases. So for specific acts of discrimination, there was compensation directly to producers. For the cumulative effect, there's debt relief to a class, if you will, of producers that also responds to the disproportionate allocation of resources during COVID.
Those statistics are just, they're mind-blowing. They really are. Thanks for sharing that. We could go on all night, but I want to make sure that we end soon enough that we can give the Secretary a couple of minutes to say whatever's on his mind. There is so much more, though, that we could cover, and we'll just have to do it again sometime, and I hope you might be willing, Secretary Vilsack, to come back.
Absolutely.
Great. That'd be fantastic. We'd love to have you, and I know our members would as well. Before I give our special guest tonight the opportunity for some closing comments, I just want to thank him. Thank him for being here. Thank him for his service to this country. Thank him for his heartfelt belief in agriculture and in America's hardworking farmers and ranchers. At AFT, we have this little line. We have a couple of them. No farms, no food is one. But another one is farming is our future. And clearly, Secretary Vilsack feels the same way. So thank you, sir, for your commitment. And now, Mr. Secretary, the floor is yours.
Well, I appreciate it, John, very much. And certainly appreciate the thousands of folks who took time from their busy schedules to listen in. I wish we could have had more questions answered during the time that we had, but you know, I can't seem to answer questions quickly, so I apologize for lengthy responses. Let me just simply say that it's an honor and a privilege to serve as the Secretary of Agriculture in the United States of America. When I talk about farmers to folks who aren't farmers, I say when I ask you what you do for a living, people will say, well, I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm a pharmacist, I'm a contractor, I'm whatever. And I said, well, that tells me what you do. It doesn't tell me who you are. But when you ask an American farmer, a rancher, producer what they do, and they say, I'm a farmer, I'm a rancher, I'm a producer, that tells you not only what they do, but it tells you who they are. And I think, you know, American agriculture has two fundamental opportunities that are so vital for this country. Opportunity number one is to take the lead in this issue of sustainability, regenerative practices, climate change, soil health, and basically show the way to the rest of the country and other industries that need to step up. We can step up first, we can step up fast, and we can be successful. Secondly, we can do this as a single community, not as a divided community where we're pitting one against the other, but recognizing that every single farm, regardless of size, has a role and an opportunity in all of this. We can create potentially an understanding of unity here, which our country, I think, desperately is in need of. So, to me, that's what excites me about the opportunity here. That's what gets me up every single day. And we can do it in a way that also sends a message that we're going to treat people equitably and fairly from this point forward. Tremendous opportunity, tremendous advantage to be at this point in time in history at the Department of Agriculture, and I'm just blessed to be there.
Well, we're pleased you are there. Thank you again, and thanks to all of you who've listened tonight. And remember, if you're new to AFT, go to our website and get one of those coveted No Farms, No Food bumper stickers. Thanks again. Good night, everyone.